Welcome to MTG Pro Tutor, your gathering of insights, tips, and advice from renowned players and community icons. Connect with venerated teachers to gain the knowledge you need to improve your skills. Now, here's your planar guide and personal tutor, Sean Penrod.
Hello and welcome to episode 201 of the MTG Pro Tutor Podcast. I'm Sean Penrod, so happy you are joining us today. This episode is brought to you by Paragon City Games, where heroes play, and by you, the patrons, the listeners. Thank you so much for supporting the show directly. It really means a lot to me. It helps keep things going, keeps the wheels greased, and we can carry on. We just passed episode 200. As I mentioned, this is 201. And thank you so much for making this show a reality and making this whole thing real and fun and just exciting. If you're just tuning in and missed the announcement, we are doing a giveaway, a Modern Masters 2017 booster box. The whole thing, all 24 packs, we're giving it away. We being MTG Pro Tutor and Paragon City Games, you can go to mtgprotutor.com/giveaway200. So /giveaway200. Basically, you answer a super easy question to make sure you're not a robot. You put in your email address and done. The submission period is still open for a couple days, so head on over there if you haven't yet and throw your hat in the ring. Other than that, it's just an exciting time to be playing Magic. We had the Pro Tour not too long ago. I'll be reaching out to the top 16 players from there and bringing them onto the show, seeing how they did it, what they did, and learning from them. We have a great guest lined up for you today, as per the usual. And just generally speaking, I am super excited about life. My wife and I are expecting our third baby literally any day now, and I cannot wait. We don't know what it is yet. Our oldest is a girl. Our next is a boy, and we said once we had one of each, we weren't going to peek. So this baby's going to be a surprise, and I just can't wait. I'm just bubbling over. Literally any day the baby's going to come, we are so excited. But anyways, as I mentioned, we have a fantastic guest lined up, so let's bring him in, sit down, and talk about Magic. What's up, everybody? I am super pumped to have our guest with us today. Our guest is a longtime grinder from the United States Midwest, with a couple Pro Tour appearances and one Grand Prix Top 8. Coming to us from St. Charles, Illinois, prodigies near and far, let's welcome the one, the only, Jack Dobbin. Jack, how you doing today?
I'm good.
Excellent. Are you ready to delve into your mind and share with the audience tips and tricks to take their game to the next level?
Yeah, all those things. Let's do it.
Sweet. Now, prodigies out there, Jack is not on Twitter, so you won't be able to connect with him there. But you can find him. Jack, are you on Facebook?
Yes.
Kind of? Was that that's kind of hesitating there?
There's a little bit of hesitation there. I'm on Facebook, but I'm probably not going to be replying to a ton of messages on it.
Well, we actually have a Prodigy Facebook group. That might be the best way to connect with you. Maybe we can get you in the group, and then other people in the group can say hello or whatever. That way you don't have to friend a bunch of people who would just want to, you know, dive into your life.
Yeah, sure. I can drop in. You got it.
Yeah, we'll see something like that. So, Jack, we love learning about our guests outside of Magic before we do the inside Magic stuff. So what do you have going on out there in St. Charles? Are you born and raised there? Are you going to school? What do you have going on?
No, I was born and raised, well, not born and raised, but I grew up in Southern California.
Oh, what part?
Orange County.
Nice.
Around like Mission Viejo, if anybody knows the area.
Yeah.
So I grew up out there. I came out here in 04 for college. So that'll tell everyone how much of a geezer I am. And I've basically been around here ever since. So these days, live in a house with my wife. I've got a 16-month-old kid. We're kind of out in the boonies a little bit, and I work down in downtown Chicago, got a long commute, and play Magic when I can.
There you go. What did you go to school for?
I got my undergrad in math and then my master's in finance.
Excellent, excellent. And what do you do in downtown Chicago?
I do corporate development for a large online loan company. So what that entails is everything from setting up new partnerships with other lenders or banks to a little bit of M&A activity, mergers and acquisitions, to sort of figuring out what our strategy should be going forward, what kind of demographics we should target, where we should expand our business, stuff like that.
Excellent. Now, how do you connect that with Magic?
It's a lot of just sort of having like a lot of skills at once and combining them into one goal. So like, for Magic, you need to have like emotional stability, but you also need to like have some concept of statistics and numbers, and you need to be able to like have foresight while still concentrating on, you know, the turn that you're on right now. So it's a lot of that stuff. It's figuring out like how can we advance our business right now? What's our business going to look like in 2 or 3 years? If we have an opportunity come up, you know, you never know if an opportunity is going to turn out good or bad, but you can do your best to sort of try and figure it out and project and you know, you make the best decision you can with the data that you have on hand.
Awesome. Well done. That was a very, very good answer. I love that. Especially, like you said, taking various skills and combining them into one goal. You know, and you mentioned a bunch of different things you do at work. And then, you know, you mentioned a few things in magic, you know, the emotional stability, which I love that that was the first thing you mentioned, deck building skills, card evaluation, and then in game, you know, navigating the situations that pop up that may be familiar or not, and all for the end goal. Like, that was really cool. Well done. Well done. Well done. So we would love to hear your origin stories. Take us back to the day. Tell us the time, the very first time you ever saw or played with Magic cards.
Oh man, we got to go back before that. So the way I got into Magic back around the turn of the century, I was, you know, I was into the whole Harry Potter craze, like a lot of young teenagers were at the time. I think this was about the time that, I don't know, the third or fourth book was coming out. They were just starting to like make the movies and stuff like that. And so Wizards of the Coast, the smart people they are, they jumped on this opportunity as well. And they made a Harry Potter trading card game. It wasn't good. It wasn't well designed. There wasn't a ton of support for it as far as I know. But I really enjoyed it at the time. I played a lot. I played on Apprentice, which some people might know Apprentice from back in the day. It's sort of a very stripped down program that you could play Magic or, in this case, Harry Potter on. And I forget... I might have played it on a Magic League sort of offshoot at the time. But anyway, so I played Harry Potter. I enjoyed it a lot, but then I sort of grew out of it. And Wizards, I think, stopped making it, or at least stopped trying as hard. So at that point, it was just an easy transition to turn to Magic. And like, that's what Wizards sort of had in mind the whole time, I think, with not only this Harry Potter game, but with a lot of the games they make. I think they're sort of, they try and funnel people into Magic. So kudos to them. They succeeded. So at that point, I got like a very bare bones explanation of the rules from some guy that I played Harry Potter with. My brother and I got like starter, you know, like the old starter decks or like pre-constructed decks. And this was in Odyssey block. So I had like a blue-white deck with Mystic Zealots and blue-white threshold control-y cards. And my brother had like black-red aggressive cards and we did not fully comprehend the rules at the time. So, for example, my deck had the card Milliken in it, which, if I'm remembering correctly, I think it was like a 2-mana artifact creature. I think it was like an 0-1 or an 0-2. And you could tap it to like mill a card and make a colorless mana. And so at the time we thought that, okay, so I play this on turn two. On turn three, I tap it for a mana. Cool, I've got a mana in my mana pool. The next turn, it's cumulative. So I've still got that mana in my pool, and then I tap it again. Now I've got 2 mana, and so the next turn I got 3 extra mana. So needless to say, I won basically every game that we played. So he quit. He stopped playing after that. But I just kept going with it.
That's awesome. Yeah, Milliken, that is, you're spot on. It's an artifact creature, 0/1, tap, put the top card of your library into your graveyard, add a colorless mana to your mana pool. It was just reprinted in Eternal Masters. How about that? Very cool. So that was... So first of all, I think it's funny. I played a lot of card games like when I was a kid. I had not even heard of the Harry Potter card game until just now. And like, I played Battletech, Dune, the Wheel of Time one, like all these, like Babylon 5. My brother and I, we tried everything, and I haven't even heard of Harry Potter. So that is really funny that was out there. And just like you said, it kind of filtered you back into Magic, which, like you said, was probably their goal. So like you said, well done to Wizards. So Odyssey was your first set that you came in on?
No. That was just like the pre-constructed decks that we picked up at the time. It was actually the set that had just come out when I started was Legions. So right in the middle of Onslaught block. So needless to say, the first time I saw an instant or sorcery was a huge surprise. I guess for people that weren't around back then, Legions was a creature only block. So only creatures and lands, I guess.
Wow.
Wow. Or sorry, set. That wasn't.
Yeah.
So that was around the time that I started, and then I got playing sort of competitively, like pretty quick. I was living in Southern California. There was this shop called affectionately The Shop. I think the actual name was like Tom Sport and Tom something and something, TSS.
That's TSS.
Yeah, there you go. And so there was actually quite a few like pretty good players around back then that played at the shop. I guess if I can name drop a couple of them, Mark Lolligue, who he's sort of on and off the Pro Tour. Like, he doesn't really put a ton of effort, I think, into the game these days, but he's won a couple Grand Prix. And then Matt Sperling used to play at the shop, but I think he had gone to college by the time that I got there.
Nice.
But I still used to play a ton with his brother, Alex. So there's like a pretty competitive limited scene at the shop, and it was just the best. It was like, this shop was the platonic ideal of what a shop should be. It was just super laid back. You could show up after school any day and just there'd be a draft going on. The owner didn't really care what we did. Like, we didn't have to pay exorbitant prices to draft. It's just like, bring your own packs and you can do the prizes however you want. And so it's just a great environment to learn how to play. And you could basically get as much magic in as you wanted.
That's awesome.
So yeah, I was pretty hooked from the start there.
So what's been your favorite set since then?
My favorite set. Well, so I play almost exclusively limited.
Okay.
So my favorite sets tend to be the ones, that have the best limited environments, and specifically like limited environments where I have a lot of success or am like able to find a deck or a strategy that other people don't. So probably Theros Block is my favorite draft environment, because it was a very good limited format. It was balanced. There was tricks. It wasn't too gimmicky. I don't really like gimmicky draft formats because it sort of rewards people who just like, get lucky in the seat that they're in, I think. But so Theros wasn't too gimmicky. It had a ton of flexibility and like cards that could be used any number of ways. I forget what those cards were called where you could, oh, bestow. You could like have a creature that either you bestowed as an aura and, or it could just be a creature. So it just gave you a ton of flexibility. Scry was in the format, so you had a ton of decisions to make. There was this card, God's Willing, which I think was like white instant. It cost just a white, and it was like creature gets a protection from the color of your choice and you scry or something like that. But I mean, that card was just fantastic. But the cool thing about Theros was, unlike most blocks, like triple Theros was fantastic. You add in Born of the Gods, which was kind of a mediocre set on its own, but when you added it into Theros, it was still a pretty good limited format. You added in Journey into Nyx, and the full block format was great. I mean, just throughout that entire block, it was just really well designed, and the limited format like never got stale, and it was, I think, probably the best limited format that Wizards has made for a full block. So, yeah, I'll go with that. And it was also like, I don't really get too much into the Magic storyline or lore or anything, and I'm not a big like, I'm not really into the whole fantasy genre kind of stuff in general of outside of Magic. But the top-down design was just so flavorful, and like, they're kind of replicating it in Amonkhet, it would seem. Mm-hmm. And hopefully this set plays out similarly to how Theros did, in that regard. But yeah, so, I think it was just a well-designed block.
So obviously we're playing a little bit with time travel here. As of right now, have you not been able to do any Amonkhet? Did you do the pre-release or anything online?
I played like one pre-release, and then kudos to Wizards again for getting this set out on Magic Online so quick.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, I've had just like tons of real life issues to deal with this week. So I'm a little behind the times. So I've not been able to do any drafting yet.
Not yet. But obviously, when this goes live, it'll be in a couple of weeks, so you probably have a few in your belt. So yeah, I would love to hear what you think of this one, if this is a gimmicky set or whatever, but having not been able to draft it yet, we'll have to shelf that discussion, I guess.
Yeah, well, so what I've seen so far is it seems pretty good. It seems like it's just sort of nuts and bolts Magic. You're rewarded for reading signals, you're rewarded for sticking to like a a two-color deck, and there aren't cards like Silvergill Dowser where like if you just happen to be in the Merfolk seat, that's a card from Lauren that was just absurdly powerful. Where if you just happen to be in the Merfolk seat in your draft, even if you didn't know what you were doing, maybe the draft just had five Silver Guildhousers and you just like had this insane deck anyway. So those are the things that I generally hope are not present in formats. But I haven't seen too much in this set. So
along the same lines of set, what is one of your favorite cards?
My favorite card is definitely Cruel Ultimatum. I think most people that know me will understand that I enjoy that card more than should be enjoyed.
So for those of us who don't know, what is it? What does it do? And why do you like it?
All right. Cruel Ultimatum. So when I have to play Constructed, I always gravitate toward like the dirtiest, slowest control deck that has the big top-end finisher, whether it's Cruel Ultimatum or Sphinx's Revelation or even Imposters like Dig Through Time. But Cruel Ultimatum was just sort of like the end-all be-all of top-end control finisher spells. So it was a sorcery from Shards of Alara. It cost blue-blue, black-black-black, red-red, And I'm not sure I'm going to even include all the text because it just has so many cool things that it does. But it's like you draw three cards, you return a creature card from your graveyard to your hand, you gain 5 life, and the opponent discards 3, loses 5 life, and sacrifices a creature.
Yep, you got it.
So yeah, so I mean, basically your deck, you basically just build around getting to 7 mana, 7 very specifically colored mana, and cast this, and then it should be pretty easy to win from there.
Man, yeah, it's pretty fun. So my cool story with it, definitely not on the big stage or anything like that, but I do pack wars with my bro. So that, you know, for those of you who don't know, basically you get a booster pack, you open it up without looking at the cards, you add 3 of each mana, and then you just play the pack. It's kind of a cool way when you're just kind of ripping packs to actually get value out of them instead of, you know, just going for the rare and then putting the commons away that you'll never see again. Anyway, so we're playing with Modern Masters 2017. And long story short, I had him on the ropes. And sure enough, he draws Cruel Ultimatum as the rare in his little pack. And he's like, takes a double take because he doesn't, you know, play Magic as much as I do. Reads a card, casts it, and I'm like, yep, that'll do it. And so obviously it turned the game big time because, you know, in Mini Masters or whatever it's called, Pack Wars, it's one booster pack. So, like, you got, I mean, the gameplay is very linear, you know, and so he played that, and it was just fun to kind of go through that experience of, oh, hey, like, this thing works in the smallest of scales and it works in the biggest of scales. So it's a really fun card when you are on the casting side. And sometimes, you know, when you're just playing casually, it's fun to be on the other end too. So. That's cool.
Yeah.
Man, that's awesome.
I guess my Cruel Ultimatum story is just embarrassing. I actually played it at the Pro Tour in Modern, which was not a Cruel Ultimatum friendly format, but I did it anyway. I played this like super dirtily blue control with like Think Twice and Mystical Teachings, and you're not going to believe this, but I went 0-4 and Constructed.
Huh. I wonder why that happened.
Yeah.
Well, awesome. Well, thanks for sharing that. I love learning a little bit about your favorites, your set, and your card and whatnot. So when you started taking Magic seriously, kind of stepping up, what was an early aspect that you struggled with that was a challenge for you, but that you eventually overcame?
What did I overcome? I would say maybe just like not being stubborn. Maybe not when you're drafting and you open that sweet card and you just got to know that it's not always going to end up in your deck, and, you know, not forcing an archetype, and just being really flexible, seeing card. And that's not only for limited, but like when you see a card in constructed, like don't think of it as only being played in this deck or in this situation. But I feel like these days I'm a lot better at just being really open-minded on how cards can be played, what situations they're good in, but also just thinking of like totally different ways that they can be played.
So on the note of forcing, you know, an archetype, for example, we have not talked about that in a long time. So what is that? How do you avoid it? More importantly, you talked about getting fixated on a really good card and kind of forcing and going that direction. Talk to us about that.
Well, you know, obviously like limited has bombs, and sometimes you have a nice flexible bomb like a Smuggler's Copter or something that can just go in any deck. And sometimes you have a much more difficult to play bomb like, for example, Cruel Ultimatum. So let's take like the recent Modern Masters 3. So if I opened Cruel Ultimatum, pack one, pick one, I would 100% take it and force Cruel Ultimatum control in limited like every single time. But that's because I'm stubborn and I just really want to play Cruel Ultimatum. But you know, for the average player who's just like winning, looking to get better, be successful in their draft, like that's not a good strategy. Cruel Ultimatum is just way too, as powerful as it is, it's just way too committing of a card. You can easily get sucked into that deck, and then maybe the person next to you is taking all your Sidraxis Spectres and all of your mana fixing, and then just like you force this deck and it doesn't work out, and instead you should have been drafting like the blue-white momentary blink deck or something like that.
Yeah, it's really important to, especially early on in the draft, to not, you know, like you said, get fixated on this card. Because even, you know, the first pack you should take the best card, and then the second pack you should take the best card. And I would even say third, fourth pack you should take the best card just to kind of see what is open. And then after about that point, you kind of say, oh, hey, you know, three of my first five picks are green or whatever it happens to be. That's kind of how I approach it and try and not get stuck in, you know, forcing an archetype. Just say, hey, just because I got this awesome, you know, Elsbeth or whatever, you know, the bomb is of the set when you first open it up, doesn't mean you're going to end up in those colors, because it might be the only good white card that you have for the entire draft. And then you're stuck with a whole bunch of crappy white cards and one bomb.
Yeah, and I'll actually give a good example of that. That happened just at Pro Tour Dublin a few months ago. I was actually in the first featured pod, and I had fast passing to me. And so I think I took a green card first. I don't remember. Well, no, I took the I'm terrible with card names. The four, Chandra's Revolution,
okay.
Four damage and tap a land. I took that first, and this is up on the draft viewer, so anybody can go back and review. And then Matt passed me Monstrous Onslaught, which I had pegged as like probably the third or fourth best uncommon in the set. And there was also like a few other good green cards in the pack. So I was like, oh, okay. So Matt clearly wants me to be in green. I'm going to take this Monstrous Onslaught. I think it's a fantastic card, and it looks like green's going to be open. So I'm going to take that. Next pack had, some mediocre cards, like probably the best card in the pack, or at least what I thought at the time was Reverse Engineer. But I ended up taking Welder Automaton so that I could sort of stay a little more open.
Mm-hmm.
It went with my first pick, the red card. It could be played, with Monstrous Onslaught if need be, like if you just need a 2-1 for two. But, you know, if you're playing Monstrous Onslaught, you want a bunch of creatures anyway. So, you know, like a red green deck can be good for that. But there was no green card. And I actually, you know, despite what I thought pack two of green just being totally open, and that I was going to be able to bank on getting more green from Matt, I actually didn't see very much more. And luckily for me, I didn't allow it to train wreck my draft. I very quickly got out of green.
Mm-hmm.
I ended up taking my draft took a very strange turn, and I ended up in like a white-blue improvised deck, which my deck actually ended up quite good, I think, as all things considered how that draft started out. And it actually turned out that so Matt had taken Rishkar over the Monstrous Onslaught. So it's just it was like one of those packs that just has four green cards, and he had to pass three of them. So
interesting. Yeah. Thank you for sharing that. That's perfect illustration right there. And your first pick was red, next one was green, and you ended up in white blue. Like, that's crazy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Man, absolutely love it. That is really, really neat. So on your journey, through, you know, Magic as you've grown and improved, who have been your Magic mentors? Like, who have you looked up to?
Definitely early on, when I was playing at the something something shop, it was Mark Lolligue. There's this guy, Doug Lunn, who he doesn't play that much anymore. He still pops up from time to time, but he was sort of the local JSS master. So he just crushed all those JSS tournaments, which was I guess that's kind of an old saying, but the JSS was sort of a tournament that I think was only for kids that were age 16 and under, and awarded college scholarships as prizes, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
I actually started playing when I was like 16, so I kind of missed that boat. But Doug just crushed those things. I mean, he was just the master. So it was like him and Mark, they were the ones that really taught me how to play limited early on.
So what did you learn from them? Is there anything that specifically sticks out, either, you know, some sage counsel or just something that you just picked up from being around them?
Well, it was just like learning the basics, because I was so fresh back then. It was just learning the basics, like, you know, try not to play cards that lead you into getting two for one. Try not to play games toward a point where you're setting yourself up to get blown out. So, for example, if it's like turn three and you both have a, or if it's like turn four and you both have a creature in play, don't attack in a spot where, like, if he blocks, you're going to have to use your removal or your pump spell, and then you leave yourself opening to getting two for one by his removal spell, you know? So it's just like learning those really basic sort of fundamentals of drafting, and then also just, you know, like focusing on just draft a solid two-color deck, read the signals. My first draft ever, I think I opened like a goblin card, and it was Legion, so there's tons of creatures, and so I just forced this like goblins deck, and it was just not good. And so they sort of taught me that, hey, you don't have to just force these kinds of synergies, just draft like good cards, and removal is really good, and, you know, just like those things that you learn early on.
Yeah, that's awesome. It's so neat to look back and realize who we've had that have shaped us as players, and what we learned from them, what we picked up, either whether it's, you know, the basics like you said, or some, you know, see the Matrix moment that we really just kind of understand the next level of our game. But it's always fun to kind of reflect on that. As you've gone through Magic and gone up and down, your highs and lows are unique to you. Even though all of us as players have highs and lows, we would love to learn what your worst Magic moment was and what you learned from that experience.
Okay, so my worst Magic moment, because so my thing is I've got a lot of other things going on in my life. Magic is just one hobby. Mm-hmm. I've got full-time job, I've got wife, I've got kid, I play a ton of basketball, so Magic's like not even the hobby that I put the most time into. So I have a lot of experience to bank on and like built up skills when I'm playing, but I don't actually play all that much. My worst Magic moment was in 2011 or whatever, when they got rid of Elo ratings and switched to Planeswalker points being the thing that like qualifies you for everything. And that just killed me because there was no way I was ever going to be able to play enough to qualify, mm-hmm. to get any buys, to do anything in the game other than just play the occasional tournament. And the thing that was so heartbreaking for me was that like the whole time that I've been playing Magic, the cool thing about Magic is like it's cumulative. Every time you play, you're getting just a little bit better. You're being encountered with a new situation. You're playing with new cards. You're seeing how things fit together. So the whole time you're playing, it's like, okay, I'm getting better. I'm getting better. I'm getting better. And you hope that at some point it's going to lead to something. And you're going to have like that big success. You're going to make the Pro Tour. And so it was just crushing when they switched to Planeswalker points. Because all at once, I was like, well, I've been spending all this time in this game. I've been around it so long. And now it just led to nothing because I just basically can't play competitively anymore. There's just no way. And so my option at that point was like, just quit or figure out some other way to enjoy the game. And so luckily I stayed with it and I actually, sort of took a step back and I was like, okay, it's been a while, but let's see, let's get back to sort of the roots, like the playing a little bit of casual here and there. I even like rebooted the old trade, but I hadn't traded in years and I like got a trade binder together. I was like, okay, I'm going to sort of go back to the early days and check out what drew me to Magic in the first place and see if I can still find enjoyment in that, which I did. And as I was still having fun. And then luckily a year or whatever later, the fine folks at Wizards, realized their mistake and, sort of Planeswalker points still play a bigger role than I would like, but there's at least, you know, plenty of avenues to play competitively, without taking them into account these days.
Yeah. So, that's awesome. I love how you took us to that. You went back to the roots, you know, trading, you know, with other people and just playing casually here and there and just still being part of the game and enjoying it, while not being completely detached just because you couldn't be as competitive as you wanted to be. And then now, how, because recently you had a good finish and are you back on the Pro Tour? You have an invite or tell us where you are right now as far as competitive Magic.
Yeah. I play as many limited Grand Prix as I can reasonably get to. Nice. Every once in a while, if there's like a close or convenient constructed GP, I'll play in it. But mostly I play domestic limited GPs and then, I've been having some pretty good success for the last 4 or 5 years. If you check out the fine page MTG ELO project.
Oh yeah, I've heard of that.
They go back and, yeah. So shout out to those guys. I think they do a great job. And they provide a product that I've been missing ever since Wizards got rid of the ELO ratings. But anyway, you go to that and it's really cool because you can like track sort of how you've been doing at major tournaments over the last 5-6 years. And I've had this like really steady stream of success, where like I'm day twoing almost every GP. And I've had a ton of, really good finishes, but the strange thing is I very consistently have been like, you know, day twoing and then X4ing or X3ing and, you know, finishing good, well, but never actually having the breakthrough like top eight. So always the bridesmaid, never the bride. And so, I qualified for a few pro tours though. Like I won one of the last real PTQs.
Okay.
Back before they switched over to the PPTQ RPTQ system. And I won an RPTQ in December. So that's why I was in Dublin. And nice. So, yeah, so this Grand Prix Top 8 in Orlando in March was, it was like, finally, I got this monkey off my back. Mm-hmm. I've had the success over the last 5 years that would lead you to believe that, you know, this finish would have come sooner, but it's just sort of, you know, things break one way or the other. So for example, Grand Prix Milwaukee in December, I was X2 on day two, and I actually picked up my third loss. I finished X3 in that tournament, and I picked up my third loss to my opponent just playing turn one Sol Ring both games. So it's just been, you know, things like that that sort of kept me from getting there before. But yeah, it's just really redeeming to finally get there. And so, yeah, now I'm not qualified for Nashville. Sadly, I played a bad deck at my RPTQ. But yeah, I'll be in Kyoto for sure.
Okay, awesome. Very cool. So before we dive more into that to kind of close the loop on the worst Magic moment, obviously the flip side are our highs. And what has been your proudest Magic moment to date?
Oh, boy. I'm just going to warn the listeners. This is going to be the corniest thing you've ever heard. So get ready. But the proudest moment is like every time that I qualify and I'm able to, I get to call the wife and say, hey, guess what? We're going to Spain, or we're going to Japan, or, you know, because she makes a lot of sacrifices to allow me to pursue this hobby. You know, when I'm flying to somewhere else for a Grand Prix, she's watching the kid all weekend. When I host 15 guys over at the weekend, over at the house for the weekend to draft the new set, you know, she's got to put up with that. And so she makes a lot of sacrifices. So it's really nice to be able to, give back to her and let her, enjoy some of the rewards.
That's awesome. So whenever you travel, like for the Pro Tour, you go as a family. And I was going to say as a couple, but now as a family.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, no, we haven't brought the kid yet, but yeah, she comes with him.
Awesome. Are you going to take, you said son, right?
Yep.
Are you going to take your son to Japan?
No, that would just be a disaster. He's right at the point where like 80% of the time he's okay, but 20% of the time it's just like absolute tantrum. Just can't. I mean, anything set him off to.
Yeah, I have a 5-year-old and a 3-year-old, and we have one coming in about a month. So yeah, another kid thing. you know, on that note, how do you manage that? How do you balance that? Because, you know, like you said, your wife, you know, makes a lot of sacrifices. You can do, you know, magic, and mine does the same thing. She's very supportive when I have to do the podcast, for example, or when I want to go and do, you know, pre-release or go to a Grand Prix or whatever. So what do you do to kind of, you know, not keep peace, but, you know, to give back to your wife and keep that balance in the home between magic and the rest of your life?
Yeah. I mean, it's just like anything else. You got to maintain your priorities. So sometimes magic is a high priority and sometimes it's not. Mm-hmm. And when it's not, that's sort of when I get the opportunity to sort of give back some. So preparing for Dublin, you know, in January, like she was okay with me spending a lot more time playing and testing decks and stuff like that. And, but for the last couple months, there hasn't really been anything going on. So I have been playing a lot less magic. And so, for example, this week, like the new set, this, remember we're going back in time here. The new set is live on Modo or on Magic Online. And I just haven't even been able to touch it because I've just been, like fixing the fence in the backyard. I've been cleaning the house. I've been taking care of the kit, you know. And so, and then a couple weeks ago, I wanted to play some magic, but she went out of town to do this like yoga retreat that she does every year. So it's like, okay, well, this is your turn. So you just got to be very communicative and figure out ways that you can give back.
Totally agree. When we lived in Southern California, in the LA area, anyways, I would play magic very regularly, like Friday Night Magic, all that stuff. And so when my wife wanted to take a cooking class, I was totally supportive of that. And so on Tuesdays, she would go and do the cooking class, and I just make sure that was blocked off and I was home with the kid. I didn't have anything else scheduled. And then, you know, I wanted to give back because that was like a 5-week thing or whatever. And she let me play magic like every single week. So I was always, always more than happy to give back and let her, you know, get out and go do something like that. So I totally agree with you. Just kind of, you know, communicating and being supportive of our significant others' hobbies and wants and needs as a thank you for them letting us spend so much time and effort into this hobby, which does take up a lot of time. So awesome.
Yeah.
Thank you for sharing that. So one thing that I want to clue in on that you were talking about, your results and how you, you know, consistently would make day two, for example, and we're at that level. What does it take, in your opinion, to go from a day two player to a top eight player?
You just got to keep at it. And I mean, let's face it, Magic has a lot of variance in the game. I don't think there was a significant difference between my skill or preparation between like the tournaments that I've finished very well for the last 3-4 years and this particular tournament where I top eighted. It's just that, you know, sometimes it breaks your way and sometimes it doesn't. And so being able to keep at it and like keep your head up, keep your confidence up. Don't go, you know, don't tilt. Don't let your emotions get the best of you when, you know, you're so close and you lose that one last match to make the top eight. And you just got to sort of keep at it and just know that it's at some point it's going to help you out. But for the most part, it's just, you know, play a lot, get better. And everybody is different how they get better, whether it's watching streams or watching videos or it's reading articles or it's just jamming games or it's making sure that you're playing with other skilled players but whatever works for you is you got to figure out. But just I guess my overall point is that you can be there. There's a lot of people that are just there and just for one reason or another it just hasn't worked out. There's a lot of variance in this game, and so just keep with it. Just keep your head up.
I love that. And like you say, keeping your emotions in. So keep doing what you're doing, because obviously what you're doing is getting you to day two. And so keep doing what you're doing. So whether that is, you know, the way that you evaluate the metagame and come prepared to events, the number of events that you're doing between Grand Prix, you know, obviously local events and PPTQs. So all that stuff keeps your skills sharp, keeps you in the mindset, keep your skills up and whatnot. And then just understanding that if you are consistent, it's kind of a numbers game. If your skill is there, if you're consistently making day two and your skill is there, then just keep at it because be happy and ready and willing to accept when advantage and variance, you know, breaks your way and you make it because you've been putting in the time. And that's not to say that you should think, oh, I deserve this because I've been day twoing, Grand Prix for a year. That's the wrong mindset. I'm not saying that you deserve anything, but to keep at it and understand that if the skill is there, then the results, you know, will come if you're consistent and you keep it up. And then I love how you talked about keeping your emotions in check and not tilting. That's one of the things that I think, man, it's such a silent killer. And I think people are definitely more aware of it now than they were before, but it's always worth re-mentioning to play one game at a time. Don't let the results, good or bad, of one match carry on into the next match, and just understand that every single time you sit down to play, you have just as much a chance of winning as you did the last time and that you can move on up. So I love that. I love how you dove into that.
I mean, all you can do is control what you can control.
Yes.
You look at even the best players in the world and their Grand Prix winning percentage is like sub 70%. So, you know, if you consider they all have 3 buys going into a GP, still got to win 10 out of 12 rounds to top eight. And that's what, 86%, 84%. So that's higher than 70%. So on expectation, you'd expect the best players in the world to not top eight. So it happens sometimes. It doesn't happen sometimes. So for example, like that's, you know, that match in Milwaukee a few months ago where I got double soul ringed out of the tournament. There's nothing you could do. I mean, you just got to sit back and chuckle. And so, you know, you don't get upset. That was actually round 12. And like, I was able to pull it together and 3-0 the next draft to finish well. So just got to, I don't know, roll with the punches.
Yeah. Yeah. So as you've played Magic, just sat across the table from a wide variety of players and observed them and their play styles, what is the biggest mistake that you see players make? And then how can we avoid that mistake?
That's hard. Probably just like giving away a lot of information. Just like be really tight with knowing that like what you're, everything that you say, everything that you're presenting physically, like everything can be picked up by your opponent. And so just make sure that like the way that you're wearing your emotions, you know, it's one thing to keep your emotions in check, but also make sure that you're not just like wearing them on your sleeve. Mm-hmm. Try and maintain an even keel. And don't do your opponent's work for them. Like don't just give away sort of how you feel about how the game's going, how you feel about your opening hand. And definitely don't, like, some people just like actually will physically show you cards. So make sure you're not doing that. And I'm not condoning like trying to look at your opponent's cards, but sometimes you just get shown them. And so just all those like little things, just keep them really tight. Let me take all that back. The biggest thing is play faster. People waste so much time with like announcing each phase when it's not relevant, or going through the motions of like physically pointing at each land in play as they're counting it. I mean, there are way too many draws in Tournament Magic. I think it's been like over 10 years since I've gotten an unintentional draw in Limited, at least. And there's just like so many things that you can do to speed up your pace of play. You know, if all you're doing is dropping a land on your turn, just say like swamp go. Don't even like waste time picking it out of your hand and play. I mean, you have to practice playing fast like this, but right. There's a lot of things that you can do to increase your pace of play.
I love that.
And, you know, draws are a huge detriment in the tournament. There are going to be, I mean, some people think fast, some people don't. So don't just like start throwing away games because you're making mistakes, but just, you know, really work on the little things that you can do to speed up your game. Besides like, you know, some turns you just got to tank. You just got to do it.
Yes.
But when you're not, like when it's just, you know exactly what you're doing, like nothing that he or she could do, nothing that your opponent can do can change what you're going to do. You just got to think on their turn, figure out, oh, if they play this, what am I going to do? If they play that, what am I going to do? Just have an idea of what you're going to do. And then you don't have to like think through everything again on your turn, and just get through your turn, pass the turn back, and then, hey, everyone's got time for lunch.
I love it. And I can hear, you know, the passion in your voice and how, you know, how much like we start recording with you right here. And I love that. What do you do about the other guy or the other person? Because you're doing your part and you're playing quickly and the turns that you can, you're going quickly. So that way you can think when you need to think, and your opponent is just going super slow. So, you know, I hate unintentional draws as well. And so I always try to make sure that I'm doing my part. What do you do when the other player is not doing their part?
Yeah, that's it's always a tricky and awkward situation. Luckily, what I find happens is that as I'm dictating the pace of play, a lot of times the opponent will try and catch up, so they'll play faster as well.
Okay.
To try and match. But when that doesn't happen, especially, you know, I don't want to point out the new players, but sometimes it happens with new players. They just sort of, you know, they haven't played as much and they got to take extra time. So, it sort of depends on the stakes of the match.
Okay.
How I'll react to that. If it's like a Grand Prix, then if they're taking too long, you just got to call the judge over. And unfortunately, you know, mad props to our judging community, but, I don't think that for the most part, they're well trained or prepared on how to spot slow play and how to enforce it. And, I know it's a big issue for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. It's really hard to know what's slow play and what's not. So, I'm not saying there's an easy solution, but, you just got to call the judge over and be like, you know, can you just please make sure that a reasonable pace of play is enforced in this match? Don't make a big deal out of it. Like, don't try and show your opponent up like, yo, this guy, he's playing really slow. You just got to, be very, again, just like keep your emotions in check, but let your opponent know that like this isn't really acceptable and we have to finish this match before, you know, time runs out.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, yeah. And it starts early. Like I've been in game ones and I keep looking at the clock. I'm like, holy crap. Like this is not a sustainable pace at all. I totally agree. Especially like you said, depends on the stakes and whatnot. So if you're at a Grand Prix, call over a judge, like you said. And I like the way that you said it. Be very, like you said, keep your emotions in check, be diplomatic about it, and just ask the judge, can you please make sure that a sustainable rate of play is maintained in this game or something like that? Just not, like you said, don't point out your opponent, be all rude, stuff like that. I read an article one time by Melissa Del Toro, and she said basically saying things like, hey, we need to pick up the pace if we're going to finish on time. Like, even though it's them, you can say that to kind of like, you know,
yeah, exactly.
Stuff like that. And then if those efforts don't work, then just call the judge, like you said. I totally agree. I hate unintentional draws, and there are, you just have to set the pace. Like you said, if you're playing quickly, then they'll try and keep up and keep things on pace.
And here's the thing too, is if you don't enforce that, the match is being played quickly enough, like that's a mistake, just like any other mistake in Magic. That's a mistake just like throwing away a creature in combat or, you know, playing the wrong spell or what. I mean, there's a lot of ways to make a mistake in Magic, mulliganing incorrectly, whatever. And making sure that you can actually finish your match, that's, you know, if you don't do that, that's another mistake that you can make.
Yeah. So see, you have what, 50 minutes. So that's just over 15 minutes per game, right? And so if game one's taking longer than 15 minutes, then yeah, you should probably think about picking up the pace or calling a judge or something. And obviously that's not hard and fast. It's kind of a rule of thumb. Just kind of think that up, you know, if you're playing three games in 50 minutes and kind of break it up. So good stuff. Mm-hmm. Thank you for sharing that. I absolutely love that. Absolutely love that. So what is an aspect of magic that you have applied to other areas of your life? What have you learned from magic and taken somewhere else?
Definitely. It's the process of making decisions based on incomplete information. And just knowing that like it's going to work or it's not, you know, you got to make the best decision, that you can. And, given the information that you have. And so, the way that I applied that was for about 5 or 6 years, I was actually trading commodity options, at the Chicago Board of Trade. And every time you make a trade, it's like, this could work out. It could not work out. You feel at most like 60% that the trade's going to end up in your favor.
Wow.
And so, you know, that's just like, every time you're presented with a mulligan decision of like, I've got a two lander, is this going to work out or not? Mm-hmm. I think, well, let's see, I'm like 60% to hit a land in the first three draws, in which case my hand's great. If I don't hit it, I'm probably just going to lose, you know. And you just have to make sure that, you know, magic actually conditioned me for that job. Just the years of, yep, kept the two lander and it didn't work out, or I mulliganed and then I looked at the top card and it was a land, you know. Just years of just getting beaten down over and over by variants. It just sort of conditions you to just be used to it and just embrace it and just, you know, put yourself in the position where if it does pan out, it's going to be great. And if it doesn't, it's, you know, it's going to suck. But, as long as the pan outs happen more often than they don't, then, in the long term, you're going to be successful.
Love it. And turning the lens inward on you, what's the deepest thing you've learned about yourself from playing Magic?
I guess that it's fine. This kind of goes with a lot of the themes that we've been talking about. You can have a good time while losing. Hmm. Things aren't going to go your way sometimes, but you know, even if I hadn't top eighted in Orlando, if I had lost my last match and once again been on the sidelines, I just spent a weekend in Orlando, stayed at a resort with some of my best friends. Saw people from across the country that I only get to see every few months. We had some awesome Cuban food on Saturday night. So, you know, luckily for me, the Magic tournament went great, but even if it hadn't gone according to plan, I mean, we played basketball on Saturday morning. Even if I hadn't played in a Magic tournament that weekend, I would have still had a great time. Mm-hmm. So just figuring out ways to like really enjoy my Magic trips and the people that I'm around, no matter what's going on in the actual Magic game.
Ah, that's awesome. Absolutely love it. And you've talked a lot about how limited is your best format. So what advice do you have for limited players? Let's say someone who's newer to Magic and they're getting into drafting and things like that. What's one thing a brand new limited player should focus on?
Make sure that you're paying attention to your curve. This is one of those sort of fundamentals that, like I had said earlier, I learned early on. Sometimes you just got to take that 2-1 for 2 over the flashy 6-mana, multicolor, whatever. Because, you know, you're never going to get a chance to cast it if you get run over too early. So, just make sure that your deck has a plan to it, I guess, also. And cards, this is a lot more than just the one.
That's fine.
The one piece of advice, but, cards are going to change drastically, depending on what kind of deck you're drafting. So you can look at a rankings, like for example, that, Frank Carson puts on Channel Fireball at the beginning of each format, and you can draft exactly according to those rankings. And you're going to end up with like a deck that, of cards that are, some of them are probably going to be pretty good, but your deck's not going to make sense. You really want to make sure that your deck has a really sound strategy. And that can mean cards go way up in pick orders or way down in pick orders. Mm-hmm. So for example, my day one deck in Orlando, it was sealed deck, but I mean, this still holds. My deck was a super, super grindy blue control deck. I had two reverse engineer and two two of the mage that fetches a 3-mana artifact.
Yeah.
And so just like a ton of built-in card advantage. I knew I was going to win most late games, but I didn't have a lot of like removal. And so, and there were certain card types that could just give me a lot of problems. And so I actually played two of the, what is this card called? It's the 1-mana artifact that you could pay 7 and tap it and sacrifice it to destroy it permanent.
Oh, yeah.
I don't remember what it's called.
Yeah, I don't remember.
Universal Solvent. That's what it was.
Okay.
So I played two of that in my main deck, which like normally that's just an unplayable card, but there were a few things going for it in my particular deck, where it was just like, it was seriously my best card in the deck for that first day. It was good with getting out early reverse engineers. And then it just like my deck could always get to the late game. But then if there was a problem that I couldn't solve, then I was just going to die anyway. And so it just fixed that. Like it fixed flyers. Here's an example. I was playing against Alex Majlaton in round 3, and he got a Chandra up to 8 loyalty, and I was at like 5 life or 7 life, and he was just going to ultimate it and kill me with it. And he was at 20, and I had like no creatures in play, so he definitely had time where he was just going to play 2 spells and kill me with it, but I actually top decked that thing, and like I had no other outs in my deck. There might not have even been outs in the format besides that card, and I top decked it. I killed his Chandra, and I won with like 1 card left in my library.
Wow.
So anyway, that's a roundabout way of saying that when you're drafting, there are just your deck will have certain needs,
right.
Whether it's you just need a critical mass of 2-drop creatures to be able to apply pressure. Sometimes you just need a couple tricks to be able to make all your 2/2s able to attack. Like if a format has a bunch of 2/3s in it or things with 3 toughness and you have all these 2/2s, like you're going to need a couple tricks to be able to get through those things. Sometimes you have this great control deck, but you don't actually have a way to win the game. And so you've got to take Gear Seeker Serpent, you know, first pick or whatever it might be. So just remember that picks are super fluid. Make sure that your deck has a really solid game plan and it's really focused, and really adjust your picks toward that end.
Absolutely. I love it. You've shared a lot of really good advice, especially in the limited world. And I know that, man, I know I've learned a lot, and the prodigies have learned as well. So Jack, as we close things up, what is one last parting piece of guidance you have for us? Either something you already said that you want to emphasize or something new you want to leave with us here at the end?
Just, you know, remember to have fun. Magic's a game. This is a hobby. There's way too many times that I'll hear someone say something like, you know, I want to play in this tournament, but the prizes aren't, you know, it's not good enough EV. Just like do what you want. This is just a hobby. It's just have fun. Whether you're winning, whether you're losing, whether you're playing a real format or a casual format, whether you're playing in a Grand Prix or FNM, there's so many ways to have fun with this game. And to advance your skill level, and just make sure that having fun is what it's all about.
And Jack, I want to acknowledge you for your contributions to the multiverse. And thank you so much for your time and for sharing your experiences with us. You are a hero among planeswalkers, and it's been a blast chatting with you. May you never be mana screwed. Always draw what you need and depart every plane victorious.
All right, John. Thanks a lot.
Jack, thank you so much for coming on to the show. Prodigies, you know where to go. mtgprotutor.com/Jack Dobbin is where you can find the show notes, which will have a brief synopsis of what we talked about, as well as links to any resources that were mentioned, including mtgprotutor.com/giveaway200. Giveaway 200. So that is the Modern Masters 2017 booster box giveaway that Paragon City Games has provided for MTG Pro Tutor to commemorate episode 200 and to kick off our partnership. So this episode has been brought to you by Paragon City Games and the patrons. Thank you so much. mtgprotutor.com/Patreon is where you can go to learn more about that. ParagonCityGames.com is where you can go check them out. And mtgprotutor.com/giveaway200 is where you can go, if you have not yet, is where you can go to enter into the drawing for the Modern Masters 2017 Booster Box Giveaway. Whew. The submission period will be open for a few more days, so head on over there quickly. That's it for today, wrapping up another fantastic episode. Get out there and play some Magic this weekend, and I cannot wait to connect with you on our next episode. Until then, I'm Sean of The Gathering, and we will see you in the next cast.
This round of MTG Pro Tutor is over. So you don't miss a single episode of MTG Mastery, be sure to subscribe to the show on your preferred podcast listening service for more exclusive interviews, deck building tips, and elite content. Or visit mtgprotutor.com to stream it straight from the source. We look forward to helping you think and play like a pro.